Hi there, good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, and on the web, you'll find us at the all-new JimboTalk.net. Nice to have you with us on the program tonight, as we're going to be spending a couple of hours looking at our veterans. Two different perspectives, two different guests, and two different subjects within that overall topic. We're getting another visit tonight from freelance journalist Joshua Coors. He's got work you can see in The Nation, also on ABC News, in such broadcasts as Nightline and World News with Charles Gibson. He came to us before with articles about Army Specialist John Town, and tonight we're going to be introduced to Sergeant Juan Jimenez. Joshua, good evening.
Good to be with you, Jim.
For those who don't recall, perhaps it's a bit of an overview, the story of John Town before we get into Sergeant Jimenez.
John Town was a soldier who had served in Iraq and was struck by a rocket while serving there. The explosion blew out a lot of his hearing, and when he filed for disability pay, sought medical care, they said that his deafness was caused by a pre-existing personality disorder. And because of that pre-existing condition, he was ineligible for disability pay, long-term medical care, all the benefits that one would associate with a war-related wound. And of course, Jim, the importance of his story was that it had happened to tens of thousands of soldiers in the last few years, saving the military over $12.5 billion in disability and medical care.
Now, a couple of things that we should probably bring up here. One would be, again, for those who did not hear that first interview, how can a personality disorder have anything to do with your hearing?
It doesn't make any sense at all. And in fact, in part two of my series, I spoke with military doctors who said they were pressured by superiors to purposely misdiagnose wounded soldiers. One gave me the case of a soldier who came back with chunks missing from his leg. His military superiors pressured him to diagnose that as personality disorder.
So, again, I just wanted to have people to get a little bit of the background that goes into our discussion here tonight. And something else that perhaps people might not be too clear about, and that would be the whole issue of who is paying here. Granted that it is pretty chintzy and unbelievably cheap to be trying to nickel and dime our veterans, particularly ones who have given limb and in some cases life for the service of their country. But I would have thought that a lot of these expenditures would have been incurred by the Veterans Department, not the Pentagon.
Well, it's a mix. The immediate medical care is handled by the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And then you're right, the long-term pay, the long-term benefits is a tax-paid operation through the Veterans Affairs Administration.
Mm-hmm. But to suffice it to say, enough of the expenses borne by the Pentagon that there has, in your findings at least, been a genuine effort from apparently on high, that is to say, not just a few misdirected, misguided individuals, but an orchestrated effort to nickel and dime our veterans to save a few bucks. Have I overstated your case?
Not at all. I think it's a pervasive situation. In fact, since we last spoke, a memo was released from an official at a VA facility in Texas. She was the head psychologist there at this facility and was pressuring her doctors to diagnose pre-existing conditions like personality disorder. As she wrote, "We simply don't have the money to pay for long-term care."
Again, that shouldn't be the effort. You provide the care. If you run out of money, then Congress reappropriates money. There are, at least in my value system, there are optional items and there are mandatory items. Mm. And whether or not we build a bridge to nowhere or even a new highway, those will fall under the category of optional. This is not, in my view, optional. Why don't they just provide the care and present Congress with the fait accompli? Do you really wish to run for re-election by having voted against an appropriation to pay for these folks? I mean, it seems to me it would be no skin off the military's nose to just take care of their own and put the onus on Congress.
That's a great point, and that's what the veterans groups are saying. In fact, the VA apparently has a block of money it has yet to use, And the Veterans Affairs Committee in Congress has told the VA flat out, we're willing to give you whatever finances you need. They're saying they don't need any more money. It's just that through situations like the personality disorder scandal and the situation with Sergeant Juan Jimenez, we're not seeing that money making it to the soldiers.
Again, there are elements of these stories that just defy belief, and one of them right off the bat has to do with any bureaucracy ever anywhere that turned down money. Whether they needed it or not, whether they were running out of it or not, bureaucracies by their very nature absorb more money. They find ways to spend it. They'll get platinum line file cabinets if they must, but they never, ever, ever turn down an appropriation. And of course, there is some logic behind this, because traditionally in the past, if you award the XYZ Bureau $1 billion and they only use $800 million of it, then guess what they get appropriated next time? Maybe $802 million. So they tend to spend every penny. What possible reason was given by the VA for saying, we don't need the money? I mean, they must have offered some excuse in the face of presumably evidence such as you've unearthed. But aside from that, just plain old empire building. Why would they turn it down?
It's a great question. I think one of the reasons is a PR standpoint. The military and the VA have both been aggressive in trying to limit the number of casualties and injuries from this war. With the personality disorder situation, they could say soldiers were wounded before they went to Iraq. And in situations with Sergeant Jimenez and the others in this class action lawsuit, if they say that the soldiers didn't deserve benefits because they didn't have an injury that stemmed from war, they're off the books.
How could
and
they
no
possibly,
longer a cost of
how
the
could
war.
They, first of all, the idea that we've turned our military into some giant khaki-clad HMO is in and of itself an abomination. But beyond that, I mean, they're sitting here right now with the world's worst conceivable PR problem. Again, I'm trying to understand, Joshua, but how do you invite the worst imaginable PR problem? We're screwing over our veterans. I mean, it doesn't get much worse than that, other than, I don't know, kicking your dog or cheating your mother out of her oxygen. I mean, how could they possibly consider this a PR coup?
You know, Jim, as a journalist, you dig and you find things. The explanation for those things is a whole nother operation. I think that's more a question for them to answer than
Fair
for
enough.
Me.
All right. Well, we're going to come back and we're going to learn some more. I knew that the people who hadn't heard the first interview had to have this overview before we deal with the tale of Sergeant Juan Jimenez. We're on the Jim Bohannon Show tonight with Joshua Kors, a freelance reporter. His work, again, may be seen in The Nation and on the ABC News broadcast Nightline and World News with Charles Gibson. His website is his name, joshuakors.com. That's joshuakors.com. We're on the Jim Bohannon Show, brought to you by Franklin Templeton Investments, providing a unique perspective through the specialized expertise of Franklin, Templeton, and Mutual Series. Franklin Templeton Investments, gain from their perspective. We'll be back here at Westwood One. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're talking with reporter Joshua Kors and his work in regard to the treatment of our wounded veterans. So we gave you an overview and mentioned the case of Army Specialist John Towne. Tell us, if you would, now that's the story that is in the current issue of The Nation magazine, the tale of Sergeant Juan Jimenez.
Sergeant Jimenez worked in Baghdad. He ushered top administration officials through the war-torn streets there. A very dangerous job. He came home with two Purple Hearts after roadside bombs exploded and blew shrapnel into his face. That traumatic brain injury left him with seizures, headaches, memory loss. When he came back to the U.S., he applied to the VA for disability care. They told him, no, that his wounds were actually caused by drinking too much Red Bull, and as such, he was denied benefits.
Too much Red Bull?
The energy drink, yes. you can imagine that was shocking and angering to him.
Don't they even try to make up something that's plausible? I mean, what is that supposed to mean? I mean, maybe if you, I don't even know what's in Red Bull, but maybe you could attribute something like internal poisoning of some sort, diabetes. I'm just making stuff up, but holes in the body?
Well, it was actually even more confounding than that, because not only did they say that his physical problems were due to this caffeine overload from Red Bull, but he came in his wounded state, had a seizure while he was in the VA facility, began being treated by his VA doctor with epilepsy medication, and then the VA raider, the one that decides whether he gets disability pay, says there wasn't enough evidence that he had seizures.
In other words, he had a seizure directly in front of everybody, the ultimate slam dunk eyewitness circumstance, and they said that wasn't a seizure. What were they claiming? Since he clearly had engaged in some kind of, I assume, thrashing about, were they claiming that he was giving an Academy Award performance? I mean, what was the charge?
They claimed that his injuries were based on an oral history and could not be documented.
Did they deny that some kind of a traumatic event occurred in front of them? I mean, again, if they're going to do this, if they're really doing what you say they're doing, you have to at least pick something plausible. Did they have an explanation for his, again, I'm just assuming, thrashing about?
As you can imagine, Jim, in the wake of all of these articles, I get a flood of phone calls from veterans across the country. One called me the other day who damaged his cornea in Iraq. They said that was caused by personality disorder. This here you have seizures, traumatic brain injury caused by Red Bull. Don't look for it to make sense. And Jimenez, to his credit, instead of simply being frustrated, he went and joined a veterans group that sued the VA. This resulted, this class action lawsuit, in a federal court hearing in San Francisco, which was extraordinarily unique because it forced top Washington officials up onto the stand to defend for the very first time precisely the actions that you're discussing, why they were denying care to obviously wounded soldiers.
What's the status of this suit?
Well, the judge, Judge Samuel Conte, decided that the veterans were right on the facts, that they were being delayed and denied care, but that he didn't have the jurisdiction to step in.
What level judge was this?
This was federal court.
A U.S. district court judge, first level of federal court.
That's right.
And why would a federal judge not have jurisdiction over any branch of the federal government?
He ruled that this was the purview of the VA and of
the
Congress.
The VA is not an independent body unto itself. I mean, if the VA, if for example, were to engage in some kind of fraudulent action, maybe I'm being redundant, basically, considering what we've talked about, but I mean, it isn't as though that they're answerable only to God. There are judicial steps that can be taken against any federal jurisdiction, and those start with the U.S. District Court, Federal Appeals Courts, U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, right now the Veterans Group is appealing its case to the Ninth Circuit, and we'll see how that turns out. With the legislative side of things, Representative John Hall from the House Veterans Affairs Committee has put forward a bill to simplify and strengthen the processing of the VA. But what made this case so extraordinary was that really all of the horror stories came out, and you got to hear from some of these officials. Michael Wolkoff, one of the top officials from the VA, had some particularly troubling statements. He was trying to defend a key VA statistic that disability claims take about 6 months to process. Now, Jim, I'm sure many of your listeners will be shocked by that in itself, that wounded veterans have to wait an average of 6 months before they get their benefits. But as was revealed by his testimony, those figures are actually tremendously twisted. It turns out that 6 months is only the first step in the process. If a veteran appeals his case, as 32,000 veterans did last year, it takes another 3.5 years for the review to be handled. And this one truly shocked me. Another way for a case to be resolved is for the soldier to kill himself. According to the VA statistics, a death counts as a resolved claim.
In other words, if somebody had a case, let's say that they were denied proper care and they committed suicide, that soldier's family would be unable to continue pursuit of the case because his death or her death would be deemed the end of it?
Well, it would be a lot more complicated, but at the very least, according to their statistics, it would be recorded as a resolved case, so that if they're saying on average they take 6 months to handle a veteran's claim, and a veteran is denied care, waits 4 months, and then kills himself, they actually speed up their numbers, because according to those figures, the case was resolved in just 4 months.
I would hope that suicides don't constitute a statistically significant portion of these resolutions.
Well, actually, as many of the veterans groups are saying, it's becoming an epidemic. CBS News did an extraordinary study on this, and they found that in 2005 alone, 6,250 veterans were killing themselves. That's 120 a week, 18 suicides every day.
Out of what, our total veterans population, which is how many? I mean, I assume by all veterans, we're talking about back as far as World War II, right?
We are talking about a large population, but it certainly is skyrocketing with the War on Terror veterans coming back, many of them in difficult state with post-traumatic stress disorder. The internal emails between top VA officials that were exposed during this trial show a lot of nervousness amongst them about these figures. Dr. Ira Katz being one, he's a top health expert at the VA. He had gone before Congress and said everything was great with the VA. They were being tremendously successful with the ill and suicidal. And in fact, he even said that CBS's suicide figures were absolutely absurd. But then,
well, they certainly, on face value, would certainly seem exceedingly high. But again, I would assume that something like this is a matter of public record. Either it is or it isn't.
Well, the VA keeps a lot of these numbers close to the chest. It takes a lot of good reporting to get at them, a lot of Freedom of Information Act appeals. And in front of Congress, he denied this flat force. But then, as soon as he got back to the privacy of his computer, he wrote a fellow official at the VA to say CBS's suicide figures were right on. And he even added this concern. He says that we are identifying about 1,000 suicide attempts per month among the veterans we see in our facilities.
All right, now we're coming up on a break here. I'm just curious, how did you get those emails really quickly?
They were aired during the trial.
During the trial. All right, yes. Stand by. We'll come back with more. Joshua Corr is our guest on the Jim Bohannon Show here at Westwood One. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're talking with freelance reporter Joshua Corrs of The Nation about his look at this particular case regarding Sergeant Juan Jimenez, who was denied benefits by the Veterans Administration because he couldn't prove to the VA's satisfaction that his injuries were incurred in Iraq. So the result was quite a rarity, an individual soldier suing the Veterans Administration. Just to go back to this judge's ruling that he lacked jurisdiction, how there must have been some basis for saying that. This is a federal agency. How could a U.S. district judge lack jurisdiction? Now, there are special cases, patents, for example. Patent infringements have their own special breed of U.S. courts. There are secret courts that have to do with certain aspects of intelligence. But this is pretty much, from a judicial standpoint, your run-of-the-mill, garden-variety federal suit. And, of course, a U.S. district judge has jurisdiction.
Well, what the veterans groups were asking for was something a bit larger than fixing their individual cases. They were looking for a radical restructuring of the way in which the VA processes disability claims. One of the veterans leaders compared it to Brown versus Board of Education. They wanted the judiciary to step in and alter a major government organization, a VA with a budget of $94 billion a year.
Of course, for the court to do that, obviously there has to be a constitutional basis, which there clearly was in Brown versus Board of Education. What is the constitutional basis here by which now we are talking about a question of jurisdiction? If you want to change the way an agency does business, that sounds very much like a legislative prerogative.
That's right. They said that the delays constituted a violation of their due process.
Huh.
And by that sense, that the judge needs to step in and remedy the situation.
Now you're getting deep into lawyer land here. I don't know.
I have to tell you, that's one of the key portions of this problem. When coming in and filing for a disability claim, American law bars soldiers from hiring a lawyer to file their claim. I got to tell you, Jim, I have an Ivy League education. I sat through every day of this trial. It was rivers and rivers of legal jargon. How somebody who is brain damaged after being struck in the head in Iraq could come back and go through this process on their own without a lawyer is anybody's guess. To simply file for a disability benefit, you have to fill out a form that is 26 pages long, and it is full of medical, legal, and financial jargon.
When you speak of this prohibition, I'm curious, that applies, I would assume, to active duty personnel.
It's for soldiers, veterans, who are going to apply for disability pay. It actually extends all the way back to the Lincoln administration.
There wasn't a Veterans Administration back then.
That's right, there wasn't. This even predates the official solidifying of the organization. The president was concerned that soldiers coming back from the Civil War would be taken advantage of by lawyers as they sought benefits from the government, and so Lincoln capped the lawyer's pay at $10.
What, the lawyer's fee, you mean, in a given case?
That's exactly right.
At a fixed monetary amount, which I don't know how long it took for inflation to make that a pointless thing, but obviously sooner or later lawyers would simply refuse to take such cases. Why was that considered? We seem to be covering a lot of territory here, but I'm just, as a matter of curiosity, wondering why Lincoln thought that was some kind of protection for soldiers. If I want to sue somebody, just let me file the damn suit. I'll worry about my own protection, thank you.
Well, they seem to have a paternal care for these wounded soldiers. And you fast forward now to the year 2008, and the effect is that no lawyer in his right mind is going to take an entire case for a total of $9.
Well, obviously. You mean that figure is still on the books?
That's exactly right. And I talked with veteran spokeswoman Carrie Childress, and she had a very interesting explanation. She says that nowadays the law is still on the books because they want to protect poor veterans. She said rich veterans would be able to get a fancy lawyer and get higher disability benefits. Poor veterans would not.
I doubt
they
that.
Wanted to even the books by denying
what
all
kind of smoke
of
and mirrors is that? First of all, disability benefits don't go to the highest bidder. This is not some court in which juries hand out claims based on how they're feeling that day. You know, $1 million for pain and suffering kind of thing. Isn't there a fixed schedule of X bucks for an arm and X bucks for a leg? I mean, is that how it works?
The veterans groups were asking an even more fundamental question. Why, after they're wounded and in need of immediate benefits, do they have to go through this process at all? There seems to be a tremendous suspicion, both from the VA spokespeople and from the books, that they're going to commit a fraud, that they're going to claim injuries they don't have. As the VA spokesman said, a lot of these soldiers are in the situation of either going to jail or going to the military, and those aren't exactly the type of people you'd want to trust.
When was that statement made?
She made that to me. She was at the trial.
In other words, this is a current statement. Back in the day and age at which there were more than a few cases, certainly in the middle of the 20th century, in which it wasn't just a movie cliche, but a matter of fact that a lot of judges said, okay, You get 3 years, or you can join the military. And a lot of judges treated the military as kind of a reform school. And back in the days of the pre-high-tech military, where weak minds and strong backs were quite acceptable, that the military accepted that as, I guess, one way to get warm bodies, since that's all they were looking for. But in this day and age, are you kidding me? The standards that apply today, a VA official would have the nerve to state that we're dealing with people who are mostly either soldiers or criminals to begin with?
And that's part of the problem.
And
the
stated that to you for attribution, a working journalist, as if this person was not even the least bit concerned about the impact of that statement?
That's their official position. These platforms do seem to be radically out of touch with the facts of the modern era, just like the $10 law for paying lawyers. But it even makes it into the books, Jim. And, you know, that's what makes this so astounding. They put up on the screen during the middle of the case the VA manual, which urges VA doctors to be suspicious of soldiers when they come in describing their wounds, especially with post-traumatic stress disorder. As the manual says, PTSD is relatively easy to fake.
Well, I'll grant you that that probably is easy to, whether or not there is a serious likelihood that that's going to happen. And given what these troops have been through, obviously it is incumbent on society to err on the side of compassion. But it is not, certainly in the cases that we've been talking about here, we're not talking about something like post-traumatic stress disorder. We're talking about actual physical wounds. We're talking about body parts that have been seriously altered by violent action. We're talking about seizures and the like. Mm-hmm. This isn't some fuzzy area of PTSD. I mean, any first-year medical student could probably diagnose most of what is going on here.
Any first-year medical student could see that Sergeant Jimenez still had shrapnel embedded in his skin. Towards the ends, with the physical situations, it's a really odd case, but again and again, their statements seem to not just bump up against reality, but have a real disinterest in the situations of the soldier. I'll give you another example. Dr. James Terry, head of the VA's Board of Appeals, I approached him with this concern about the stacks and stacks of papers that wounded veterans have to go through, even if they're brain damaged, without the help of a lawyer, particularly that 26-page form just to apply for benefits. You know, Jim, as you can imagine, a lot of the most wounded veterans look at that stack of papers and say, you know what, forget it, I just can't do it. Dr. James Terry said to me, you know, I have a PhD, but even if I only had a third-grade education, I think I could fill out the forms.
Well, let me ask you, how difficult are they? I mean, 26 pages seems like a lot, but again, I don't know what's on those 26 pages. Those 26 pages could constitute a genuine, if maybe a nitpickingly misguided effort to be precise, or it could constitute a deliberate bureaucratic roadblock designed to discourage further action. In your honest assessment, which is it?
In my honest assessment, it's definitely much more the latter. There are spaces for essays about your medical history. They ask for times and places, injuries and treatments. They ask for your wife's financial situation.
What does that have to do with anything?
The location of your wife's previous husband's wedding. It goes on on.
What does that material have to do with anything? I would assume the questionnaire was about the soldier's physical history and the circumstances surrounding the incident in question.
That's exactly right, and that's why the veterans groups are looking to change that form, just to make it one or two pages.
Well, I hope that they do so, although now I'm starting to understand why the judge would say he didn't have jurisdiction. If you're talking about wanting to change the law without a constitutional basis, or at least I'm not sure there is a constitutional basis, it seems to me they'd be a lot better off working with Congress. But we'll come back and talk about that aspect when we come back on the Jim Bohannon Show with our guest, journalist Joshua Coors. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-5426. Reporter Joshua Kors is our guest in the latest issue of The Nation. He recounts the tale of Sergeant Juan Jimenez, who was denied benefits by the Veterans Administration because they say he can't prove that his injuries were incurred in Iraq. He has sued the VA. That case now has been deemed not within the jurisdiction of a U.S. district court. There is an appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In the meantime, based on your description of what the veterans want in this suit, and it has now become, I gather, a class action suit, is that right?
That's right.
It would seem that a much more likely course of action would be the legislative route. Has there been action taken or efforts made to obtain a bill in Congress?
There has. Representative John Hall of New York has put forward a bill, H.R. 5892, which passed in July, which would streamline the process and allow wounded veterans to get benefits a little more quickly so they didn't have to jump through all the hoops that currently they have to. But, I think what was even more interesting than what was at dispute at the trial was what wasn't in dispute. Everybody there knew that more soldiers are killing themselves than are dying on the battlefield in Iraq. And everybody knew that when the veterans come back and seek benefits, they begin in a waiting list that's 650,000 veterans long. The question
now, a waiting list for what? For benefits of any sort?
For disability benefits.
Disability benefits. Okay, now in terms of soldiers committing suicide, now since we're covering so much territory here, perhaps we need to make the distinction between a soldier and a veteran. Are we talking about more people who have more active duty soldiers or more veterans who have committed suicide than have died in action in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Forgive my language. We're talking about soldiers who fought in the war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan and have come home.
Okay.
More of those soldiers, now veterans, are dying than the 4,000 that have died abroad.
But are they, just to make sure I'm understanding, dying of suicide?
That's correct. That's correct. It's what they're calling an epidemic, and certainly one can see from the numbers why that is. The question is what to do about it. Dr. Frances Murphy, a top doctor at the VA, she stepped forward and began to discuss this as a crisis. She was honored for her mental health care at a Washington ceremony a few years ago. And at that speech, before top officials across the country, she said that mental health care is not available in all corners of the country, and that even when it is, with the delays and the lack of programs for families and rehabilitation, it's almost inoperable. Days later, she was fired and replaced with Dr. Ira Katz, the gentleman I told you before who wrote that secret email acknowledging that they were receiving 1,000 suicide attempts per month. And I don't think I got to mention the end of that email. Essentially, he says, keep this quiet. We should address this ourselves in some sort of release before someone stumbles upon it.
The email came out during the trial.
That's correct.
Again, I'm trying to follow all of this. Tell me why this Dr. Cass is not guilty of perjury by testifying to one thing and then admitting in an email that precisely the opposite was true. Are perjury charges pending against this doctor?
I don't think they are,
but why wouldn't they be? I mean, did you not make a case? I mean, if I say A before a court of law under oath and then admit in an email that A is a lie, I mean, why would that not be a slam dunk case of perjury?
In my article, you'll see several documented instances of his false testimony before Congress. What's going to happen there with his career, I simply don't know.
Well, it shouldn't be a matter of his career. It should be a question of whether or not any perjury is a criminal offense. I mean, his career be damned. Why isn't he behind bars, or at least on the way to being behind bars? Has any U.S. attorney suggested that perjury charges be brought? And if so, why not?
It's early. My piece has just been released a few days ago. And I have to tell you, the general attitude inside the government is essentially a hands-off approach. Dr. Robert Rosenheck, a top mental health official at the VA, had a very good summary of this. He was asked whether the VA knew all of the problems with its delays and its inability to provide care. He said, yes, we did. And the lawyer said, did you create a plan to fix these problems? He said, yes, we did. And they said, well, why didn't you enact the program? And he said, quote, it's a very difficult question. It's sort of like asking, why didn't the dog bark in the middle of the night?
Well, whatever. In any event, I fail to see why it isn't in the vested interest of some U.S. attorney to seek perjury charges against your good doctor if in fact what you just say took place. We'll come back. We'll have more. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. Get a fixed rate loan you can live with. Go to LendingTree.com today or call 1-800-555-TREE. LendingTree. When banks compete, you win. Our guest is Joshua Kors. We're talking about the case of Sergeant Juan Jimenez and his battle with the Veterans Administration. So the court case is now at the appellate level, and there is a bill introduced in terms of changing the law. Does either seem to have, based on what experts have told you, a likely prospect for a happy ending?
I don't know. It's still very early in the process. And that goes with the perjury charges as well. As you know, with my last series of articles, there were huge repercussions down the line. Congressional hearings, the law that was passed by President Bush in January. So we'll see where this goes. It's still very early. And we'll see whether there is some legal repercussions for Dr. Ira Katz. As it is right now, the top officials of the VA are really getting by simply saying they don't know. In fact, if the audience remembers the Alberto Gonzalez testimony before Congress, that's what it reminded me of. Michael Wolkoff, the deputy undersecretary at the VA, he must have repeated, I don't know, I can't remember, about 40 or 50 times. There was one point, Jim, that really caught the ire of the veterans who were sitting next to me. When the question came up about the Rand Corporation study, you might remember this study, it was front page of every paper across the country. Rand Corporation found that 320,000 soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan have brain damage, and 300,000 have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap on that note with thanks to Joshua Kors. Stay on the line, please. You can find this latest article in The Nation magazine. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One.